And we are back with episode 248 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I don't care if I'm duct taped to this chair, just come on at me, I'm ready for you.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and Annie, please reconsider, Augie's really not all that good.
Yeah, well, you know, how can she really resist? I guess it's that blind man charm. But we're going to give you an episode of Revolution in Sympathy.
Oh, geez, haven't I suffered enough?
Apparently not. But first, before we talk about all these things, obviously we are going to be doing Walking Dead, Covert Affairs, and Revolution. But Edmund, I think we have a disclaimer we have to do first.
Absolutely. We will discuss absolutely anything and everything that might have happened in these episodes, so we have to warn you, you will be spoiled. As always, we have waited at least a week or so before we do that, so you've had plenty of time to catch up.
Absolutely. And well, we are going to start right in on The Walking Dead, and here is the promo.
On the next episode of AMC's The Walking Dead.
How about my baby brother? You can't tell me he's alive and then hold off on where he is.
Ready? Down.
No.
Their people may come for him.
Down. From by this guy who calls himself the governor.
Okay, well, that was interesting.
Yeah, it's
getting intense,
I suppose. Yes.
All right. So let's see. Let's go ahead and do our recap. And this would be Season 3, Episode 7, When the Dead Come Knocking. The governor tries to get information out of Glenn and Maggie. Michonne arrives at the prison. Yeah, I'd say that they're using some interesting methods for interrogation.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting because, Gary, I've now gotten about, into the, I think I'm to issue 48 now. So not only do I know how things went down with Laurie in the original version of the story, but
yes.
I've seen how the governor does interrogations in the comic book. Hmm. I have to imagine that you were having the same thoughts that I was having when he came around that table after asking Maggie to strip down.
I was yeah. Well, cringing might not have been the right word, but I thought to myself, wow, they're really gonna go there. Okay.
Yeah, how is this gonna work with network standards? Mm-hmm. But
yeah, it's like guys,
well, I gotta admit, once she took her top off, I thought they were actually gonna do really go for
oh, yeah.
it. I was like, no, really?
No, please don't. Please don't. yeah, Edmund, I'm sure that you can kind of figure out that things got a lot more disturbing in the comic when it came to...
Oh, yeah. That info had kind of slipped out there rather quickly after the Glenn and Maggie had been taken, with people speculating about exactly that. So
Yeah, I thought maybe they'd go... they'd go Hitchcock and like do a shadow or something, maybe, but...
Mm-hmm. One thing that was interesting about that was the way they kind of, I mean, they let you know the whole thing of, you know, the two of them, you know, were right next to each other and able to hear everything. But I actually thought they were going to play that up a little bit more than they did. Especially when it looked like, you know, they were going to really stretch the boundaries on basic cable. I think that was such a major element of the story for those who had read the comic that it was almost like the producers were like, you know, playing on that anticipation.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, literally going as far as they felt they could without, you know, I mean, still making it, you know, incredibly menacing and, you know, difficult to watch, but, you know, without actually crossing that line.
Well,
for her, but poor Glenn. Good gosh, they, you know, not only does he literally get the, you know, crap beat out of him, but then on top of it, he has to take on a zombie with his hands tied behind his back and does it.
Yeah, that whole sequence was absolutely amazing. I found myself literally, you know, jumping off the couch, going, you know, smash the chair.
That was easily one of the most intense scenes that they've had because at this point, you know that there's a really good chance that they're going to take people out.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They, you know, people who are supposed to quote unquote survive have been killed off already on the show. And they have a whole stream of characters that weren't ever in the original story that are already well established. So they've gone well off of the script, so to speak. And for Glenn and Maggie to be the ones to be captured and taken to Woodbury, and then for Glenn to be so horribly brutalized. I mean, for one thing, it changes up the expectation because, again, you know, they really did, as you were saying, play up the stuff with Maggie because they wanted you to think, oh boy, here it comes, here it comes. When really they were doing far more with Glenn. In Glenn's case, in the original story, he was kind of left almost untouched. They messed with his head. So they did a real inverse here. And you know, let her hear everything that was being done to him. And of course, in the comic, I mean, yes, you know, it wasn't Maggie that was there with him at the time. Certainly, it doesn't, you know, it matters a lot more for those two to be captured together on the show than it would have been the way that it had originally played out, based on how the relationships have played out over the course of 2.5 seasons now. But wow, yeah, Glenn taking down a walker with his hands tied behind his back and no real weapons to speak of. Yeah, I'd say all that life experience has kind of come in handy.
Yeah.
yeah, he didn't need a knife on the end of his arm to get that job done.
Well, you know, he makes even a point of that as while he's getting interrogated. You know, they've been on the road. You know, he does sort of, you know, give a hint of that, you know, he's not going to break easy. They've been having to deal with crap for a while now, and that seemed like it infuriated his interrogator a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having, you know, especially since Marl had seen them at their what should you say, more innocent, less seasoned phase. But it's also interesting, I mean, how that's going to play in terms of the, you know, this, you know, the conflict to come in terms of, you know, sure, yeah, Marl may think he knows them, but but that's one they've been pointing up since the opening episode this season, you know, sort of, you know, how much of a, you know, cohesive fighting force they've become.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that's kind of been revealed very subtly, I would think, is as much as the governor has such a stranglehold over Woodbury, mm-hmm. It wasn't this episode, but the previous episode, you had Andrea out on the wall with one of his best people.
Mm-hmm.
And their sharpshooter starts taking shots and is missing.
Yes.
And I noticed that too. Yeah. That was...
Well, I mean, is missing and aghast when she takes it hand to hand.
Right. Exactly. Because, you know, probably very intelligently, they have made that restriction that they're not supposed to do it because, well, they'd get their butts killed. Mm-hmm. But it does speak to the big difference between the prison gang and the people at Woodbury.
So the prison gang's tougher than the townies. Is that what
you're saying? That's exactly right. As Glenn points out, they've been out there surviving, and they're a good fighting force. They know how to deal with these things. They know how to work together, and the people in Woodbury really don't.
No.
And I'm sure that's going to come into play as we go into this season, this mid-season break.
Yeah, even when you look at the wall in Woodbury, I'm like, wait a minute. It's like a single wall. There's no fallback position. And I'm like, you know, if a big crowd came and pushed through that wall, they got nothing. Yeah. You know, even from a quasi-military standpoint, you're like, shouldn't you at least have a second line of some sort of catch or something?
Right, exactly. You know, that's the whole point of the prison. Why the prison is so good is that it has the triple gate system, the triple fence system, is that, you know, you can trap them in between and take them out if you have to, never mind the fact that you've got so much high ground. That's one of the other things that I was kind of noticing is that, you know, we've seen our friends, you know, Rick's gang at the prison up on those guard towers sniping down the walkers.
Mm-hmm.
And in Woodbury, I don't see people up on the buildings. So they're relying on that wall for their defense. And like you said, Gary, that's clearly they are not thinking in a military type of situation. They're not thinking of a siege type of atmosphere. They're very complacent right now. And
They are. I mean, as much as we like to feel like, oh, they're well set up. No, they're really not. You get a good herd through, and I don't know if they're going to be able to rally troops quick enough to stop them from getting in.
And one could even argue that the only reason that they haven't is because Rick and his people have been running around all over, driving the herd towards them instead of getting to Woodbury.
Yet, as we have to go through Woodbury all the time, we keep going through the red zone, and I'm like, oh, really? Oh, how interesting that we have to keep going through the red zone to get to Woodbury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also they've kind of talked about a little bit, but I guess they've been culling any large numbers that they have out there to use in their little experiments and in their games. So it could be that they are just keeping a certain radius around the town just clear. But certainly it's a relatively large area to enclose. They've only got the one wall. Yeah, I think that the little infiltration that Rick's little team is going to be attempting is going to reveal a few vulnerabilities, and I don't think the governor is going to be very happy about that fact.
No.
So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Well, it seems like they're naive in general. I mean, if you want to look at what I guess in a sense is Act 3 of this, is this whole testing phase that they were doing with the elderly gentleman. It's obvious. I think was it Andrea included. They don't know what they don't have a clue what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, they're asking for trouble, and you know why? I mean, it's all underlying in the context of everything.
Yes.
That you know, the governor is trying to find a way to bring back his daughter in some way, shape, or form, and because he's so fixated on that. That's all he cares about. That's what the whole thing is about, is to the community exists in order to create the safe zone that he needs in order to conduct these experiments for all intent purposes. And that's just going to blow up. I mean, it has to. And this, you know, having Rick and his people in a more secure position and now leeching off of the same resources that they've been relying upon, you know, the governor, his operation has always been to, as we've seen with the National Guardsmen earlier, when he finds anybody out there with other resources, he co-opts them. He kills them off and takes what they have. And as we even said, that's not necessarily a bad strategy if the goal is to actually keep everyone alive, but that's not what he's fixated on. it's going to be ugly. You know, now on the flip side, we have what's going on over at the prison. And we have Michonne showing up. Yeah. And go Carl. Man, the kid's fierce.
Well, it was interesting, the glances exchanged between her and Rick behind the fence. She's like, are you going to help me? I don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, you know, look, they're right here. They're coming right up next to me. You know, help a sister out. I don't know. We shouldn't be going that far. That's okay. You know, it was interesting, the body language being exchanged between Michonne and Rick as opposed to just the dialogue. So.
Yeah, I was really impressed by that because a lot of shows you'd have them doing very exaggerated gestures to get their point across.
Mm-hmm.
But here it was very subtle.
Oh, yeah.
Just little shifts here and there just so that, you know, obviously she couldn't tip off the fact that she was not a walker until it was absolutely necessary. I wonder if they rehearsed it more exaggerated so that they could get the beats down and then muted it, so to speak.
Well, I think you're right. They had to mute it. She had the people right there next to her, so she couldn't really, you know, go over the top at all to begin with and keep it believable.
Yeah, it was a really good scene. And then also the interrogation, because you had that counterpoint between Merle and what he was doing with Glenn and then the governor and Maggie, and then you had Rick with Michonne. And at first it seemed like he was going to be just as brutal as Merle was being, because, you know, sitting there and jabbing her in her wound and everything else. And then very quickly he took a different tactic, and I can't say that they trust each other all that much right now, but I think that the mission to go infiltrate Woodbury is going to create that synergy. You know, obviously there's going to be some tension there, and I think they're going to really play with that in the second half of the season. But I just really liked how they played up how the two different sides were doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also felt very in character as well. I mean, for both Michonne and Rick. You know, the job, and yes, of course, I've looked at the name, but I haven't had the job that Dana Garai has been doing. I mean, as Michonne, you know, I mean, where she, you know, barely says anything, but, you know, I mean, not, you know, not not just at the fence, but you know, the way she can go through these episodes and just express so much and just do it all nonverbally has been really pretty amazing. And, you know, just really came to a head here.
Mm-hmm. I was a little bit, I was trying to think of my one slight disappointment in this episode was the, what seemed like a completely unnecessary side trip into the cabin.
I still didn't quite understand how the, you know, I'm going to call the cops. Maybe he was just so tired that it was a reaction without, you know, thinking is all I could equate it up to. You know, if somebody wakes you out of a deep sleep, he might have, you know, not really been sort of focused on the apocalypse at hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or just to show how we may be thinking of Rick as the hero here again, because he's going in to, you know, take down the big bad governor who has mistreated Maggie and let Merle do his thing. But Rick is still more than happy to take a guy and throw him out into the walkers. So
I disagree in some sense. I think if Michonne had not killed the guy, Rick would not have thrown the guy out.
Maybe not. I'm not convinced that he was dead, because where she stabbed him was not necessarily a lethal wound, at least not immediately.
Yeah.
Well, geez, I don't think running through your chest cavity, even missing, you know, the heart or anything like that, given the current state of medical facilities, is going to keep you alive.
No. That's why I say not immediately. Yes. I would have expected that he would have bled out. It seems below the shoulder, so it would have definitely probably.
Well, he pretty much did. You saw the blood pouring out onto the floor. So I mean, right. I got the sense that he was bleeding out already.
Right, but I'm sure that they left it ambiguous on purpose. But for me, it seemed like it was like, well, he's dying anyway. We might as well use him as a we might as well use him as a diversion.
It was still pretty cold. Zombies were just up front. Yeah, that was nice. Yeah.
Well, they're not smart.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not expecting 360 degrees, but you think maybe one would have scattered.
One got a little lost and then went, back door. Yeah. But at any rate, I wasn't quite sure what that was about. If only that, you know, it was going to put them in jeopardy of being detected. I didn't get a sense of where it was relative to Woodbury anyway. I mean, it was just down the road, but to your earlier point though, Gary, I mean, they got surrounded pretty damn fast.
Well, they, you know, they made no secrets that this is a highly dangerous area. You know, they call it the red zone for a reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it didn't necessarily surprise. Well, I guess the number of it did, but that they ran across several at one instant doesn't surprise me. They've been telling us this is the bad area. So it didn't surprise me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it did finally confirm that, yes, it really is the bad area. Because there was sort of those hints of, you know, wait a minute, is this just the governor's way of controlling people? And is it really that bad? But no, I guess this did confirm.
Well, I mean, we got to remember all the way back at the beginning of the season that there were a couple lines where they said that they've spent the last 9 months going around and they've just been turned around because they keep running into herds.
Yeah.
And so this is their last chance. I mean, if you remember correctly, they kind of were on the road and they had no idea where to go, and they just happened to walk into the woods, and right there was a prison, which I thought was kind of funny, because now in retrospect, weren't they looking at a map at the time? I would think a prison would be marked on there, but anyway.
I've just kind of ignored the fact that, you know, yeah, that closing shot of last season, you know, seemed to imply that they were like, you know, half a mile from the prison.
Yeah. You know, we'll let that go.
I've been letting that go.
Yes. But at any rate, I mean, yeah, I guess they have established, and this is another great little thing about the show, is that they do insert a lot of information into the dialogue, and you've really got to pay attention because there's a lot of detail there. Whatever the case, they've done a really nice job of leading this up to this confrontation that they're going to have in the mid-season cliffhanger. And yeah, I really enjoyed this episode quite a bit. I mean, I had that little nit about the fact that the very end seemed a little tacked on, and I'm still not sure exactly what the purpose was, but I don't know. That was just a minor consideration. I don't think it took too much away from the episode. Bronze Thumb gave this one a 9. What would you say, Gary?
I am new to the television series, so I might not be quite as invested in the characters as someone who's been watching it all along. But it felt like I give it an 8. A 9's a little bit higher in my range for what I feel is worthy. And it still had some plot holes. I thought the whole governor intimidation thing was a little weak. And other than Glenn getting beat to a pulp, the scenes didn't do much for me either, as far as the, you know, sort of trying to shake him out into answering, you know, telling where the prison was, or rather where everybody was at. There were a lot of holes for me. The whole subplot with trying to discover how to make zombies friendly or bring them back was really weak, in my opinion, too. So I'll stick with an 8.
Okay. How about you, Edmund?
My feeling is around an 8 as well. You know, partially it felt like a bit of a, you know, even despite the intensity of some of the stuff going on, this was still a bit, you know, a bit of a transition episode, you know, leading up to this big confrontation. And as intense as the interrogations were, I still, in a funny way, I think this might have been the fact of having gotten wind of what happened in the comics. You know, I kind of felt like, you know, yeah, you know, and understood why they were doing it, but they were pulling their punch a little bit.
Yeah, I'm still between whether or not they were pulling the punch so much as intentionally playing that up so that they could subvert the audience a bit. I'm between an 8 and a 9. Yeah. I'll be honest. I mean, it's not a hard 9. It may round up to that, and so I think I am going to put it there just so that we have both sides represented. I think that on the whole, I would definitely say that it was better than the previous couple episodes. So just in comparison, it probably gets there. But certainly, it's not nearly as good as the fourth episode of the season, where I think we were all just blown away. All right, well, I think we can go ahead then and leave The Walking Dead and move into our next show, which is going to be Covert Affairs. And here's the promo.
This Tuesday, on the season finale of Covert Affairs.
CIA wants me to finish this.
The spy game gets serious.
I betrayed Annie's trust. Wouldn't be surprised if she wanted to come.
With two life-changing events.
You've been counting on my feelings for Eyal to drive this negotiation. That was your first mistake.
Annie, don't!
You absolutely cannot miss.
I want to talk now, Annie.
The season finale of Covert Affairs.
Yes. Oh boy, the season finale of the third season of Covert Affairs, and Gary, why don't you go ahead and give us the recap as you recover from that promo?
Not to mention the months of waiting now for the next season. Anyway, we're talking about Covert Affairs, season 3, episode 16, Lady Stardust. Thankfully, while that is a song title, we were not pounded with an album, as we'll discuss later. Anyway, Annie heads to Amsterdam to take out Khalid after a fellow spy, Eyal, is taken hostage. I have to say, looking back now at the whole, I guess, arc of Eyal's involvement in this season, I think he worked pretty well as I don't know if you want to call it a plot device. I thought they played him really well. You still feel for him at the end. But you know what it comes down to, at least in Annie's world, is trust and who's been there to help her and save her. Yes, Eyal did get her out of the prison that time, but he played her so poorly, or you know, unfairly, that obviously, as we got to the end of this episode, I'll jump around a little bit. You know, she's there with Augie, and because he's the one that she can trust, and Eyal, you know, failed that in the beginning of the season. I think that she sort of had equal trust levels for both of them, and that might have been part of the back and forth that she had, as well as we had, on where she would end up. But obviously, you know, trust wins the day. So I'm glad that it did finally happen after all these episodes of getting together to talk. You know, they finally, in a sense, well, I don't know if you'd call it talking, but they finally got together, which is what we were expecting. It leaves me a little ambivalent for the next season, but let me get back to the actual heart of the episode. I like the little twist that she didn't kill Khalid, that she, you know, set it up for him to go after his father, who was really, you know, the big player in everything. So that was a nice unexpected turn that usually this show is a little bit more direct. So to take that twist was really enjoyable for me. Trying to think what else. And then we get to this whole file episode with Jay's father, Henry. I understand they wanted to set up the next season, but what could possibly be in that file? It left me curious to some extent, but not enough to think that Annie would necessarily sort of jump on the bandwagon with Henry and go forward, which is what it's, you know, is what it seems like to me. And I was a little disappointed that it's, she sort of turned so easily, I guess, is what it was, what I'm thinking in my head. What'd you guys think?
Evan, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I had the same reaction to the ending. Be one heck of a bombshell for her to just, you know, basically glance through the file and then say she's on board, you know, unless we're entering into a whole double bluff and she's, you know, throwing in with him to, you know, get the goods for Joan and Arthur. I mean, about the only thing that makes sense to me. I'm kind of intrigued and just hoping they can pull it off. I mean, if they're, you know, going to be playing with the, her sort of playing this double game in some form, you know, while the relationship with Augie is progressing, which, you know, of course will potentially have all sorts of ramifications, which could be done really badly in maudlin, or could be, could have the potential for some interesting conflict and, character development.
Well, but after they dragged out Augie and Annie getting together, yeah, I am concerned that they're going to really go sort of, you know, melodramatic over the top with the relationship instead of keeping both people functional. So I have my fingers crossed that Augie won't be the spouse waiting at home for everything to turn out okay.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. But I mean, the stuff that was going on in the episode, I mean, I actually, you know, I liked her whole ruse for getting into the embassy. You know, I was actually momentarily taken in with the mugging until I realized, oh, wait a minute, of course, infirmary. And of course, it's no surprise. Yes, the blonde guy manages to get in to meet her. And then the whole blanks in the gun, faking IL's shooting, and actually like the way they played that. I mean, the whole thing of, you know, yeah, you were counting on, you know, he, you know, I'm involved with him, and that was your mistake. I'm not, which is actually true. Essentially, it came down to I was pretty pleased with the way they played it all out, and certainly with the way, you know, they managed to get through the IL story in a way that felt true to the characters, and yet still he actually wasn't killed, he wasn't shuffled off, you know, he's still there in the, you know, in the wing to pop up again potentially. So you know, that part I liked, but then it was this whole thing about, I mean, you could tell the whole thing with Henry Wilcox was building to something. And I mean, I even had these scenarios in my head of, you know, because especially when he told Arthur, it's like, oh, don't worry, you know, a couple of episode or two ago, oh, don't worry, you'll be fine. And it's like, oh yeah, right, he's going to be like, you know, taking over Arthur's job at the end of the season or something. So, you know, that's I'm sure that's still going to be part of the plan, but for next season. So, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of the political stuff is stuff they haven't done that well in previous seasons. So, you know, we will have to see how it works in the future.
Mm. Yeah, I gotta say that I felt like this was the perfect capstone to this season. In terms of Eyal and his relationship with Annie, in previous seasons when he was being flirtatious and kind of making a play and pass at her, it always felt very disingenuous. This time around, I actually felt like it was genuine. I think they finally found a way to make me like the character, because he treats her as a colleague, not as a wet-behind-the-ears novice. He trusts her, which is a big, big difference.
Yeah.
Seeing him and Augie working with Annie in the field just made me think that these three together would make an awesome team. I mean, mm-hmm. the banter, the interaction between them, it was just some of the best stuff that they've done. And you could tell that Eyal and Augie were both thinking of Annie, and we're both planning to, you know, make some kind of play, but at the same time, they had a respect for each other. They weren't in a really foolishly adversarial type of relationship. They both knew that they had to do what was right for her sake and for the sake of everybody's well-being. They had to back her play. And yeah, it really worked out well for me. I'm concerned only in the sense that I don't want them to come along and in the fourth season come up with artificial reasons to create strife between Annie and Augie. I think that they need to find another way for another scenario that just makes it hard for them to take things any further or much further because life just gets in the way. Maybe this case that Annie has been handed from Wilcox will turn out to be something that forces her to kind of go a little bit off her usual mission, create a little bit of tension there. But I don't want there to be some kind of, you know, I don't want Eyal to come back and suddenly become so charming that Annie starts to fall for him too. And there's this whole love triangle thing. I kind of like this semi-professional thing that they've got right now with the three characters.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a guest appearance, but I don't want another arc with him of this magnitude next season.
Well, at least, certainly not at the beginning. It wouldn't be bad necessarily to bring him in like they did this season for a concluding arc, a few episodes. But it would have to be, in my opinion at least, it would have to be more on the intelligence covert side, not the semi-romantic side. If they really want to play that game, maybe they can do it down the line, but I thought that they left things in a really nice place, that her experience with Simon had taught her that dealing with somebody in a semi-adversarial position within the intelligence community was not a good idea. Running away from her life was not a really good idea. And maybe that's why Augie was the right move for her, because, you know, her place in the CIA right now is still not entirely clear. She technically doesn't work for Joan anymore, if I remember correctly. So,
yes,
where she falls and where Augie falls is still up in the air, much as it was at the very beginning of the season. But now they're on the same page together, you know, and we'll see where it evolves from here. But I like where they left things. There's a lot of stuff that's left unresolved in the background. And there's, of course, that big question. What exactly is this case she's supposed to be working on? Does it have something to do with the whole, you know, Mossad thing that was going on? Because that kind of got dropped when Eyal left Mossad. But I have a feeling it's not that easy. From what I recall from the previous episode, Arthur and Henry Wilcox were talking about the fact that there was a lot more to the whole Mossad thing than just this little trick about the rocket strike, the drone strike.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that really went anywhere. So I'm thinking that this has to be connected to that somehow. So,
yeah, that was certainly the implication that, you know, yeah, that, you know, that drone strike was just, you know, was just one little piece of whatever machinations have been going on.
Mm-hmm. So I would expect that if Eyal comes back, it would be in that context. And he'll probably flirt with her, but hopefully, again, they won't play this game of having him become an active rival for her affections. Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was a great way to end up the season. This has been easily their best season yet, by far. Oh, yeah. I gave this a 9. I thought it was a really nice way to wrap everything up, and it was my favorite episode of the season because of how much it managed to pull together, and last season they kind of dropped the ball at the very end, so I'm really happy to see that they went out strong.
Yeah, definitely.
How about you, Edmund? What would you give it?
Yeah, no, I'm with you with a 9. I mean, basically, if it was only, you know, my slight sort of reservations about the sort of abruptness of the Henry Wilcox recruitment, the only thing that kind of got in the way for me.
How about you, Gary?
Well, I usually start at a 10 with these things, and then they have to pull down from there. But yeah, I agree. The Henry Wilcox setup for season 4 was just so blatantly glued onto the end of this that I'd give it a 9. It was, as you said, John, it was nice in a lot of ways. It closed up, you know, Eyal. It got Augie and Annie together. It closed up a lot of things. It really shows how Annie is now in charge. She can handle complex operations and carry them out very well and achieve objectives. She's really come, full circle isn't the right term, but she's definitely, you know, a professional spy at this point. She doesn't have or need any training wheels anymore. So, you know, I tried to look at it. Well, what if the show ended? Would I have been happy with this ending? And I have to say yes. So I almost want to give it a 9.5, but I'm not usually one to stick with decimals. So I'll fall back on the 9.
Well, I think you'll be happy to hear that the third season has come in at an average of 7.8, which is by far the highest that the show has gotten. And that is pushing up into the upper echelon as far as our shows tend to be concerned.
I knew you guys would come around. It was just a matter of time. I knew it.
Yeah,
and
well,
looking back, it never dropped below average for me this season, which is pretty surprising because certainly that wasn't the case for the first 2 years.
I don't know what you're talking about, but yes, it was a very good season. It was well written, and I believe we only had, I think, one episode that we sort of felt they dropped the ball on. And other than that, they've been working pretty consistently. So, yeah, I'm happy.
Yep, one fell below average as far as the group is concerned, and that was the Suffragette City episode, which was the one where the whole Lena thing went down. And we all felt that that was probably the weakest link of the entire chain. So, I'm really happy with the season. And, yeah, I'm actually going to miss the show, much like you were saying at the very top, Gary, that, we've got to wait until next summer. But, who'd have thunk it that this this show was going to really progress so far, because it
hasn't.
Me,
I would have.
Well, yes, but like you said, you start at 10 and you come down from there.
And so we know you're hormonally challenged in your assessments.
That's right. Okay.
Now,
well,
you agree she looks nice in a dress as well. I don't know what the issue is.
As I said about last episode, now we have the blue dress and the red dress.
So. That's right. Okay, well, let's go ahead then and move on to our third and final episode for our review, and that would be a Revolution. So here's the promo.
Next Monday.
This amplifier flips on tanks, weapons.
When will it be ready?
Whoever controls the pendant will control the world. And the battle for all the power is building to one epic showdown.
All will be revealed.
Miles, you gonna try to kill me?
All right, and Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give us the recap for that?
This is Revolution Season 1, Episode 9, Kashmir. To aid her rebel buddies, Nora enlists the help of Miles to infiltrate Monroe's base and assassinate him. Rachel continues work on a machine to amplify the mysterious pendants. And guys, I was really trying to get the Who to provide bed music for this segment, but that Pete Townsend is one heck of a negotiator. I just couldn't work it out.
Oh, boy. I can understand Eric Kripke has been trying to get Led Zeppelin on Supernatural for 8 seasons now and has never been able to pull it off. So for him to finally get it for this show, just it felt as forced as it was. It's like, I'm going to use it because I can, damn it. And let me just say that this song will... I love the fact that in the promo they have the one line, all will be revealed, and all I could think of is, no, it won't. Who are you kidding?
Yeah. You mean they're putting Charlie in a Skippy outfit again? What?
If only. Yeah. But no, the other problem that I have is that I will forever associate Kashmir with that time in college when I was living in the dorms and my roommate, in order to make sure I knew that I wasn't supposed to come in, was blaring that song when his girlfriend came to visit. It's like, yeah, that's not going to work for me for this particular episode. Sorry, guys. This one was another winner for Revolution, and I say that with tongue firmly in cheek.
Firmly in cheek, yes.
I understand that they take certain dramatic license on this show, certainly on any show, where it's kind of designed to be more of a crowd pleaser than a scientifically and science fiction accurate type of thing. But wow. The lack of oxygen caused hallucinations a lot faster than I think is actually possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was even worse was that, you know, Charlie obviously couldn't fall under the same thing, so she had to hit her head instead and then have then have hallucinations. And I'm like, well, couldn't she have just suffered oxygen too? You know, she's going around with everybody. Why? What is it that they like about smacking this woman's head so much on this show? She
I
gets
don't know.
Belted, hit, smacked, concussion.
I have this feeling like
she's
that,
like the Chekhov of the show.
That somebody feels like they're taking the comments on some of the message boards and forums to heart, because there's so many people that keep blaming her for why the character is so just flat and uninteresting. And I got to say, after this episode and after some reflection, you know, there was a little bit of talk about this in the comments on the website for this episode. I can't really say that this is necessarily the actress's fault, because the writing for her character is abysmal.
Oh, absolutely.
There is no depth to this character, and there's no consistency to the character.
I have to protect my brother. Is 90% of her story.
Right,
lines.
Exactly. Yeah. They've given her nothing to work with. And, you know, that's tough no matter how you cut it. It's tough to be the lead character or a lead actress on a show anyway. But to then underwrite the character so criminally is just not doing anyone any favors.
Oh, I know. I mean, if you look at Charlie versus Nora, I mean, Nora's really shining lately, and Charlie still has yet to really, you know, pull out of her, develop into someone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. To me, it comes down to the writing. The big problem for me in this episode was not Charlie. The big problem for me in this episode is that normally when you build an episode around, or any type of story around this kind of structure where you are having people... This was essentially a bottle show for the characters. I mean, they were trapped in these tunnels. They were dealing with the effects of the lack of oxygen very quickly, but they were dealing with it. So they were having these hallucinations. And normally that would do something to reveal something about the character that is relevant to their situation, or that, you know...
Yeah, expose an event in their history or something. Yeah.
Absolutely. That didn't happen at all. It felt so random. I mean... So she's afraid of the water? Why does that matter? It didn't do anything to... They didn't have the characters remembering some traumatic event from the last 15 years after the blackout, you know? They probably had more flashbacks in the next episode than they did in this one. That was relevant to that past history. Mm-hmm. That's what really bothered me, is that they had something that was perfectly designed. Granted, the explanation for why was not very good.
Yeah, and I mean, what got to me the most was, you know, yes, and they're carrying torches around that, like, keep flaring up and
keep
talking about lack of oxygen. And then, finally they remembered, we should have them, like, guttering down right at the end.
Mm. Oh, my favorite was that they were trapped behind the door with bullet holes and still suffering from the lack of oxygen.
Yes.
And my wife and daughter, who were watching this show with me, because my daughter really actually enjoys the show. That's probably the target audience. They're both sitting there going, how can they still be suffering from lack of oxygen? There's big holes in the door right there.
And they were existing holes. It wasn't like they just got hit new. You know, they've been there. And you're talking about, what, 7 to 8 people moving down a continuous shaft that's not frequently used.
Right.
I still find it hard to believe that the oxygen would have been that poisonous to begin with. You know, of course, you know, we have tunnels like, you know, around the New York City area that go underwater, but one of the biggest reasons of ventilation is because of the vehicles going through it, not the people themselves.
Right. So it just felt very contrived. It didn't really come together very well. And, I'm really getting to the point where I feel like they need to take this hiatus that they have, and I hope that they took some time off and they kind of rethought where they're going with this. Another thing that came to my mind was that this is completely different than what we've come to expect of Kripke from Supernatural. On that show, you had lead characters that were very deep, and just about every situation had some kind of relevance to their psychological situation. You know, every urban legend, every monster that they ran into, especially at the very beginning, was designed to reveal something about their past history. And it always did. In this case, we have almost the polar opposite. It's so action-oriented that there's practically no depth to the characters. And I'm wondering how much of that is his doing and how much of it is NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I really wonder if the network is so wants a show to succeed at this point that they just want to water it down to be as crowd-pleasing as possible, not challenge the audience too much. And if you think about it, there's really nothing about this show that is really that challenging. I mean, you kind of know what's going on, and there's not much to follow.
I can't remember the show that we discussed previously concerning, in a sense, the same argument that, you know, you know, are they writing a show to be popular? Or are they writing a show to be a good show? And obviously, it is popularity. They're, you know, in the business to get ratings, to sell advertising time. And we, you know, as we talk about science fiction shows come up, and we hope they're, in a sense, high science fiction shows where they, you know, discuss technological problems, societal adaptations to these problems. This is not that show.
Yeah, certainly.
And it's going further and further away from it. So it's one of those things, I think we have to appreciate it for what it is, which especially in this episode was not much. But you know, it's one of these things that is frustrating. We see good bones to the story in a sense, and they're, as you said, making, you know, a shoot 'em up action film out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frustrating. We'd like to, you know, to see, you know, you know, we get tiny flashbacks here and there, but we don't like to see how people, you know, better handled this whole issue than one steam engine to assuage all of our technological complaints that we have. You know, we want to see more of what's happening. I want to see California that they've hinted about for several episodes, and we don't know what the heck's going on, except supposedly they're bloodthirsty. What if they're really the good guys? We don't know. They haven't shown us anything, even though they tease the heck out of us.
Right. And that's, you know, Bronstum has mentioned this many times, that even though they have shown people being very relatively draconian, and they've talked about the fact that they have a tendency to be very violent, this is 15 years into societal apocalypse. The government has fell almost, you know, instantly, apparently. And maybe the Monroe Republic isn't so far off the map as far as what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I like you said, Gary, we haven't really seen anything that says definitively they are evil. They're just pragmatic to a fault. And yes, it is going to bring out some of the negative things about people. You know, we see Neville, and he is kind of letting his savagery out a little bit. But you know what? When you compare this to what people have needed to do to survive on The Walking Dead, they've got it easy. Because, they have no power. They have none of the amenities that we're used to. They don't have anything trying to kill them every 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, speaking of being draconian, I mean, what was going on with Rachel this episode, I mean, where the further we get, I mean, it just, you know, and knowing, you know, a little bit about, you know, yeah, it was Andrea Roth in the pilot. They recast her with Elizabeth Mitchell, and they just seem to be completely schizophrenic in the writing between, you know, what they wanted to be, you know, just the reprise of Juliet from, yes, Lost, Gary.
Jeez, I can't escape.
Apparently, the rumors that were floating around was that, you know, no, this, she was a much darker character, you know, possibly even sleeping with Monroe, you know, so like in collaboration with him. And, I keep feeling these little sort of hints of, you know, like the darker, more interesting show it could have been. You know, and then especially with this one, you know, where it's like, oh yeah, she's reluctantly, you know, going along, you know, and then can just dramatically stab her for, you know, her former colleague to, you know, stay in Monroe's good graces. And it just seemed to be like completely coming out of nowhere. Yeah, I mean, it was just...
Well, you say that, but yet I see Rachel literally heartbroken over seeing her son there. You know, we still don't quite know her whole story, but we get the sense that she did leave her family for some reason, perhaps to protect them, because she knew at some point she would get hunted down. And, you know, maybe she thought by her splitting up with her husband that they could, you know, avoid that spotlight. And when, you know, when the son came into the camp, you could, at least I felt that she was distraught, and she's doing whatever she has to do literally to, you know, try and keep herself in some level of importance. I don't know. In a sense, yes, it was bloodthirsty, but I don't know so much it was opportunistic so much as she didn't know what else to do to not get killed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's more, it's just I feel the character's badly drawn, because it's, you know, I mean, I haven't gotten enough of the sense of that steel being in her, you know, before this happened.
Well, I almost thought of it like a mother, you know, doing what she has to do to, you know, try and protect her family or something like that, rather than, you know, a cold, manipulative person. She just, you know, at least that's how I'm taking it.
So, okay, let's kind of put this down to the test here. What Henry gave this one, I believe, a 7, which is a little bit high in my estimation. I would probably go a 5.
Wow, I was actually going to say a 5. I'm surprised you went that down that low. Usually you're a bit more generous, but that's right where I'm at too. It was very poorly executed. As I thought the Rachel scenes were actually probably the redeeming part of this episode, and the whole contrived hallucinations as well as the overwhelming soundtrack issues really pulled this thing down for me a lot.
So where did you fall in? 5?
Yes, 5.
And Edmund?
Oh, I'll make it a triple.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean between the scientific oxygen infused and recap, you know, flashbacks, or hallucinations which didn't go anywhere. You know, it's like, yes, we kind of know you have issues with Monroe, but and even we didn't really talk about, you know, the whole sort of betrayal aspect of it. You know, even that just kind of seemed a little stilted and predictable. Yeah, I mean, overall, yet another disappointing episode of Revolution.
And yet, how did it do in ratings?
Is it dropping yet?
Well, I can look that up.
I mean, it's still got the voice lead in, so.
I love how Miles keeps saying they don't know how the lights went out. I think he's got a sense at this point. They really should redo that.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, no. The ratings, they were dropping. This episode was the lowest episode, rated episode of the series to date. So okay. There you go. But I will say that the mid-season finale did jump up almost 1.5 million.
Okay.
So it's still doing well, especially relative to other shows that we've talked about.
Well, it's nice to see there are people that actually feel the way we feel. So.
Yeah, I'd say that there's quite a few.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time.
You don't even know why you're here. Do you? I didn't mean you no harm. I lowered my gun, but you raised yours. You an asshole out there. Just like you were on that rooftop back there in Atlanta. What y'all did? Leaving me up there. People wouldn't do that to an animal.
We went back for you.
Ain't you thoughtful?
We did. All of us. Rick, Daryl, T-Dog.
T-Dog. Yeah, big old spear chucker. The one I was pleading with. The one that dropped the key. Tell me where it's at. I'm sure T-Dog liked to bury the hatchet. Let bygones be bygones.
He didn't make it.
Well, I hope he went slow. How about the rest? How about my baby brother? You can't tell me he's alive and then hold off on where he is. No? Well, maybe the farmer's daughter will help me out.